Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. This is the time and place set for the special rules hearing to consider two proposals. Record may show that due and legal notice has been given as required by our rules. As you can see, Justice Wilbur is not here. She has fallen victim of the flu bug, but is listening by the internet and will participate fully in the court's conference when we discuss the proposals after this hearing today. The procedure that we follow is that we ask those that are in opposition to the proposal to speak first. The idea being, if there's no opposition, that obviously would probably shorten the presentation of the proponents, since they have nothing to rebut. Of course, if there is opposition or concerns, then the proponents are free to say what they wish. Proposal number one, which I believe is from Circuit Judge Douglas Hoffman, would amend SDCL 1564E. Is there anybody that wishes to speak in opposition to this proposal? Okay, does anybody want to speak on its behalf? There being no comments either way, we will proceed to proposal number two, which is entitled, it would be South Dakota Rules of Civil Procedure and Circuit Courts, Expedited Civil Actions. Does anybody wish to speak in opposition to this?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Justin Smith. I am an attorney from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I practice with the law firm of Woods Fuller, Schultz & Smith in Sioux Falls. First, we'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to speak on the expedited track this morning. I suppose you could qualify my testimony as being somewhat mixed or soft opposition. We certainly do not oppose enacting some form of expedited track for smaller civil actions. We think the overall concept sounds like a good idea. Indeed, 22 jurisdictions in the United States currently have some form of expedited track. We do, however, have serious concerns with a few aspects of the proposed rules. We think that some easy fixes to the rules, making it more in line with the vast majority of the jurisdictions with expedited track, would make that satisfactory and protective to all litigants in South Dakota. And we do have questions about the necessity for these rules and the language of the proposed rules specifically. If this court adopts an expedited track, we ask that we ask for the process to either require a stipulation at the outset by all parties to use of the expedited track, or to allow defendants a right to remove the case from the track for any reason, not just upon a showing of good cause because of delay.
Don't you feel that, in essence, would kill the usefulness of the proposal?
Mr. Chief Justice, in actuality, 22 jurisdictions currently have an expedited track. Of those, 19 jurisdictions have a voluntary track. Data has not been brought forward, to my knowledge, by the proponent, showing that in those 19 of the 22 jurisdictions, somehow the track has been unsuccessful or has had no one using it. In fact, in California, which did a study on its own expedited track, and it has a voluntary track, they do actually have that being used in at least one out of every 20 cases, the expedited track, even though it is voluntary. So there is no evidence that I know of showing that having a voluntary track makes it insufficient. Presumably, the 19 of the 22 jurisdictions would have at some point either repealed their expedited track or changed the rules to make it voluntary if nobody was using the track. And in fact, most of those 19 jurisdictions, unlike Iowa, Minnesota, and Texas, have had their expedited track in place for many years. Some of them up to 20 years have had this, or longer, have had this track in place. So the second thing we'd ask is that the vital and longstanding procedures for summary judgment be preserved in the expedited track without restrictions as to the grounds for them.
That surprised me that that was, do you have any idea what the logic is of limiting summary judgment to, particularly, I think in your letter, you said the elements of the case, which is, or in my experience, summary judgment normally comes in to protect all the parties if there's not a valid claim.
That is correct. We have done some research into that issue on why Iowa, which as we say in our brief, is the only of the 22 jurisdictions which limits places restrictions on summary judgment. One of our attorneys in our firm attended a CLE in Iowa on their expedited track, which just went into effect on January 1 of this year, 3.5 months ago. One of the attorneys who was giving a presentation on the expedited track in Iowa, who actually served on their task force, made comments upon that very question. And the response was, that is the price a defendant pays for having a date certain for trial. And as I'll get into in a minute in my comments, in Iowa, this whole concept of an expedited track arose out of problems that are specific to and exist really only in Iowa and certainly do not exist in South Dakota. One of those problems, in fact, the major one that prompted their expedited track, is that litigants were finding themselves in perpetual limbo waiting for a trial date, because in Iowa, a trial date can be set and then bumped for a matter that's some kind of higher priority. So in Iowa, they adopted an expedited track. They guaranteed both sides a date certain would be set, and then they set cases of a lower dollar value, $75,000 or less, to have a priority such that they would not be bumped and those litigants would not be trapped in limbo. To my knowledge, Justice Everson, the only reason I can give you for why they placed restrictions on moving for summary judgment is because of that comment that was made
Mr. Smith, you know, after your firm filed the objections, I took the opportunity to call the Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court because I thought this was a little unusual too. And his explanation to me was that they have preserved all the statute of limitations and those types of things that would bring on a motion for summary judgment. And he said, really, if you look at the exceptions, the only thing that is precluded under the summary judgment motion is making a motion to the effect that the factual the facts don't justify the relief sought, because the theory their court adopted when they adopted this rule was you might as well try it as go through all the mechanics of the summary judgment. It's a one-day trial. Do you want a one-day summary judgment hearing and then a one-day trial? So that was what he told me, and the reason I'm throwing it on the table is because I'm interested if that addresses your concern or just what do you think about that?
Thank you, Your Honor. We would say that the rules as they're written, the proposed rules, certainly do not seem to make that clear. As they're written, they certainly seem to restrict the grounds upon which a litigant may file the motion for summary judgment. They certainly differ from the current statements in Rule 15.656, and we would ask that if that's the case, that litigants have the right to file summary judgment for any grounds, including failure of a necessary element, that be spelled out more clearly in the rules so that it's clear to everyone that you can file a motion for summary judgment. For example, based on the lack of duty in a negligence claim that we have spelled out in our brief on this issue.
Okay.
Did you? Maybe I misread your filing. I thought you just wanted summary judgment on the elements of a claim. Did you want?
That is correct. Yes, failure of an essential element of a claim, Your Honor. Yes.
So you're not asking for summary judgment and everything?
Well, that would certainly be the main ground on which we would ask that the rules be clarified to make sure that we can file for that very issue. But also questions of law were something else we discussed in our brief. If there's a question that is a legal question, our argument is that it would seem to be a mistake to allow a case to go through the entire discovery, litigation, and at least half of a trial before a motion for judgment as a matter of law could be filed, allowing summary judgment to bring into effect, to be brought, a motion to be brought for failure of, you know, for a legal issue would seem to be something we should spell out as well. So the proposed rules, the first thing we'd like is, again, the voluntary entry into the expedited track. The proposed rules allow plaintiffs to elect the expedited track and prevent defendants from escaping that track absent a showing of, quote, good cause sufficient to render the application of the rule unfair. This grants, as we see it, to plaintiffs a unilateral right to select an expedited track, and the defendants have no input into that track election and have the burden of proving good cause to terminate application of the rules from that point forward.
Well, I guess I haven't spent a lot of time looking at it, but And I don't know what the reason would be, but if a plaintiff tries to not get on this track, doesn't it give the same opportunity to the defendant to move things along and hopefully limit costs of defense?
Your Honor, Chief Justice, it would certainly give the defendant the right. Well,
you're getting the same break as the plaintiffs from that, or the you're all in the same boat.
I apologize, Chief. I would have to go back and read through the rules again to see whether or not by motion it can be moved into the expedited track. If that's the case, however, again, even if a defendant, so in that case, if the defendant moves for the court to put a case into an expedited track, the plaintiff then has to resist that motion, even though the defendant has the burden, I'm sorry, it can simply be put in there by the court. The plaintiff would then have to show good cause as to why it should not be in there. These rules are good in that they give us additional efficiencies and help us potentially, as the proponents I believe will argue, helps us to save costs on litigation, trial, and trying cases, period. However, if by doing that, the trade-off is you're giving up significant procedural and substantive rights. For example, right to more than one expert, right to a jury trial longer than 6 hours per side limitation, right to summary judgment for failure of an essential element, etc. You're giving up those significant procedural and substantive rights as a trade-off to saving the costs and having a guaranteed trial date. So what we're asking is for either party to be able to make the election, and if one party asks for it to be placed in the expedited track, that the other party be able to keep it out of that track for any reason, not just for good cause. Because in this case, what we're arguing is you'd see a plaintiff filing a case in an expedited track, thereby removing those procedural and substantive rights to save the costs. The defendant would then have to move to try and get out of that, would have the burden of proving the good cause, in order to preserve their procedural and substantive rights. So if it's on the other side and it's the defendant putting into the expedited track, the plaintiff would be at risk. So we believe the most fair way for this to happen is either by a stipulation at the outset, where all parties agree to the expedited track, or for any party to be able to opt out of that track once it's been put into it.
You're asking for those in the alternative?
Yes, Justice, yes.
So you'd like it to be changed so either a plaintiff or a defendant could elect.
Could elect to remove it, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
As I read the rule, only plaintiffs can elect. Subsection 3 only says plaintiffs. And maybe there's another way.
And Justice Inner, that was indeed my interpretation of the rules. However, I would have to go back again and read through the rules to see whether or not, and refresh my memory on whether or not there's a procedure whereby a defendant could file a motion seeking to put it into there.
You see any reason they shouldn't do that? Just make it either plaintiff or defendant could seek to put it into?
No, and many states do have the states have kind of a mixture of the way they do their voluntary tracks. Some states say you have to file a stipulation at the outset, so that all parties go into this with eyes open, knowing what's going to happen. Other states say the court, sua sponte, absent a showing of good cause, can put it in there. Some say that, I may be wrong on that one, excuse me. And some say that one defendant may opt out after it's already been filed in the expedited track. So in terms of whether or not either side can do it, I would say I suppose there's no objection to having it so that a defendant can move for it, but we would still want there to be some ability for the plaintiff to be able to keep it out, opt out for any reason, not just for good cause, because particularly from the plaintiff's standpoint, a limitation of $75,000 for their damages they may view as seriously harmful for their case.
Well, what if their pleading was $75,000?
That could be an exception. However, The purpose of having a voluntary track is to allow all the parties to go into the analysis of whether the expedited track is a good idea by balancing the fact that they're going to lose these procedural and substantive rights against the benefits that they gain from the track, the saving litigation costs and the date certain for trial. So if that analysis is not part of the equation, all parties can have the option of getting it out of that track, We think that this is a harmful thing for them to be stripped of these rights, potentially without recourse to remove it. So in the United States, 22 jurisdictions, again, adopted some form of the expedited track. Three jurisdictions only have an involuntary track, like the one being considered under the proposed rules. Those are Iowa, Texas, and Minnesota. Minnesota currently is only a pilot project in 2 out of their 10 judicial districts in that state. No data is currently available. However, they do anticipate that in the fall of this year, they may have a report coming forward on that. Texas only adopted its mandatory expedited track in 2013, and it does not expect a report until around about the same time, fall of this year. Iowa studied this issue comprehensively for at least 3 years. There was a very lengthy report of over 100 pages put out by the Iowa Civil Justice Reform Task Force, which went into very comprehensive detail on why this kind of track would be beneficial and what kinds of problems it would solve that were specific to Iowa and which do not exist here in South Dakota. The rules themselves in Iowa only went into effect on January 1 of this year, 3.5 months. We've heard that there were contacts made with some of the people in Iowa, in the judiciary in Iowa, who said that there have now been maybe over 20 cases which have gone to trial under the expedited track in that state since it was implemented. But we find it difficult to believe that within 3.5 months, a lawsuit was filed, discovered, litigated, and tried by the time, by this point.
Well, as difficult as it is, Chief Justice Katie told me there's been 28 trials since January 1, and they've gotten no complaints. So, and, I mean, that's just what he told me.
And, Chief, I can only speculate on what that means. My guess is that there were many cases that were sitting in that limbo that we talked about of no date certain set for trial, and that once this track opened up and gave them that right, that was the election that was made.
Sure.
We do not have data yet on how things also are going to work in Iowa with their mandatory track that doesn't allow for the opt-out.
You know, Mr. Smith, go ahead.
Well, just one other thing on the Iowa proposal. My understanding is it was a broad-based group that came up with this. It was both defense attorneys and plaintiff's attorneys, and I guess the reason that they agreed to the mandatory nature of it and the other terms was that everybody was concerned across the board that their associates were not getting that trial practice that they got when they graduated from law school. And they thought that that was valuable enough to obviously give in on maybe some points like the mandatory, and that's how it came about. You know, I don't do trial work anymore in South Dakota, but talking to my brethren in the DU, they tell me that it's the same problem in South Dakota trying to get young attorneys in. You can't send them in on a $1 million malpractice case if they don't have the experience, and this is one way to get it and to bring them along, if you will.
And Chief, we've heard that argument as well in our research on this issue. It is our argument that we really should not be creating new procedures in our law that would benefit attorneys, particularly where the new system takes away from litigants significant procedural and substantive protections.
All right. Well, Mr. Smith, I have a different concern, and that's that the cost of litigation has increased, and that this provides a means to keep courts affordable for a type of case where right now they may not be. And that's why I keep going back, or I keep thinking about the voluntariness, which could be as used as a tool rather than as a solution in making cases more expensive by saying, well, if you don't agree to my terms, I'm going to bump it out of the procedure, and using cost as a tool. That's why I look at you bring it to a court and explain it to the judge why it has to be opted out, to keep the justice system affordable for the people of the state of South Dakota.
And Justice Severson, thank you for the question. We would have two responses to that. The first one would be, up to this point in South Dakota, we have not heard a hue and cry really in any sector about huge costs of litigation.
Oh, we have.
Believe me, we hear it all the time.
Okay.
I had one attorney tell me, that he will not take a case unless there's a guaranteed recovery of $100,000 because he can't afford to take it. He's a plaintiff's attorney, obviously.
Right, and in many cases, issues like that will be brought before the legislature or may come out in judicial messaging or, again, in rules up to this point to try and solve some of those issues, and we haven't seen that. The second argument that I would make, Justice, to your point, I'm sorry.
The point was using the voluntariness of it as a tool.
And as we spell out in our brief, we think that as it stands now, as it is written, the expedited track with the inability to opt out or the fact that it's not mandatory or that it's not by agreement of both sides could actually be used as a weapon by the plaintiff by putting it into the expedited track with no ability of the defendant to opt out, no ability of the defendant to remove through the summary judgment process cases where an essential element is lacking in the plaintiff's claims, and that this could be used as a weapon to try and settle cases because there's a truncated discovery period, there's a truncated trial. They may not have the ability to put on all of their evidence, certainly a six-hour limitation for each side, not each party, will limit a lot of the evidence that's going to be presented. So we think that that argument could strike both ways in terms of whether or not the fact that it's not voluntary could be, and that could be a perfect option for, a perfect argument for having this as an agreement or stipulation between the parties at the outset. And then one of them can only remove it, as the rule says, based on significantly changed circumstances or for good cause at a later date.
You have cited both Minnesota and Iowa as new programs, and they're mandatory. And therefore, the jury's still out in your mind on whether they're going to succeed. What would be your reaction if we were to adopt this as a pilot program, say, that for 2 years? Would that go to your concerns that you're not permanently, for lack of a better word, hung with this?
We think the first and best option would be to go with a voluntary track like the vast majority of jurisdictions have done when they have adopted an expedited track. Have it be either by stipulation of the parties or have it allow an opt-out later at a later date. Otherwise, all the arguments that I've made would come into play. The second and fallback position, I suppose, if a pilot project were going to be considered with these exact versions of the proposed rules, that it be something along the lines of what Minnesota did, to a limited area of the state instead of just being the entirety of South Dakota. The different circumstances in Iowa, Texas, and Minnesota go to such issues as the size of their bar associations. In Iowa, before they ever implemented their rules in January of this year, they did a comprehensive survey of over 9,000 attorneys and judges to come to that conclusion. Minnesota's population is much higher than South Dakota's, as is Iowa's. Texas is certainly 30 times higher than South Dakota. So we see this as being, if we're going to try this in South Dakota with the current version of the rules being what they are, with all the problems with that, we would ask that it be on a limited pilot project basis, not simply mandatory for the entire state. But again, the best option, implement the rules as the vast majority of jurisdictions have done, and then in 2 years, if the voluntariness of the track is a problem that bespeaks a need to bring us in line more with Iowa and Minnesota rather than the vast majority of jurisdictions, then at that time the rules can be changed perhaps to make it involuntary, as it is in these proposed rules.
You had referenced a 3-year study group that prepared a report. Do you have that report with you? You held up a document?
I do, Justice Kern. I will say that it's heavily marked up by me with some highlighting and such, but
could you provide that a clean copy at some later point to the court?
Yes, absolutely, Justice, I can.
And that was a 3-year commission. Was it a group of the bar in Iowa that put together the commission? Was it a court-created commission? Do you know?
Certainly, Justice, the Iowa Bar would certainly be able to tell you more. The Iowa Judiciary would certainly be able to tell you more. My understanding, however, of how this worked is the Iowa Judiciary commissioned a task force, which was called the Iowa Civil Justice Reform Task Force, to address big concerns across the Iowa Judiciary and across Iowa litigation. For example, as we talked about, the fact that cases were hanging in limbo with no date certain, and the perception that in Iowa there were increased litigation costs. That was the report here that I have in my hand was published January 30, 2012. And then 3 years later, as of January 1, 2015, their expedited track went into effect. So I would assume that before this report was issued by the task force, their work went on for at least a year or more before this report was ever published, and certainly the text of the report seems to bear that out.
Well, wouldn't it seem that, I mean, they're studying it for 5 years. Our rules are very amendable if, you know, when they're court rules, rather than going through all of that, you've already suggested that if there's a problem one way or the other, we can amend it or we can repeal it.
And that is correct, Justice. Again, the weight of the jurisdictions in the United States that have expedited tracks, which have been shown to be successful in those 19 jurisdictions that have voluntary tracks, the weight of those jurisdictions shows that a voluntary track works best and preserves the rights of both sides in the most optimal way. So we would propose, yes, you can certainly amend the rules at any time. However, we would propose that we follow that major trend and have it be voluntary, and then at a later date it can be amended.
When you say the voluntary track, though, as I looked at the data and the sheet on the various jurisdictions, they were all over the, they weren't all 75,000. Some of them were much less, closer to small claims cases. I didn't see any that were more. So we're not really talking about the same thing in all of those jurisdictions, are we?
And you're correct, Justice. That's what I alluded to earlier. The jurisdictions, those 19, are really all over the board in terms of how you, of what qualifies as being an expedited track case and what qualifies as going into those courts. However, all of those 19, regardless of the dollar amount level, regardless of the specific limitations that they may put on the length of trial, the number of jurors, etc., they all have some type of voluntary element where either you can get out later or you have to stipulate to get into it.
Is there any data about utilization of the track in those 19 states?
Justice, I do not have anything before me except a report that came out from the Judicial Council of California discussing their expedited track, which concluded that it was used, as I said, in about one of 20 cases. They used the expedited track for those. That, without knowing how it works in Iowa, since they've only been doing it for 3.5 months, I would say that percentage is probably borne out in the states, maybe even that have involuntary tracks like Iowa, Minnesota, or Texas. But I can't tell you for certain, Your Honor. I just allude back to what I said earlier. Presumably, if those 19 jurisdictions, many of which have had their tracks in place for decades, have not seen them being utilized, they would have had the option to repeal them or change them into mandatory tracks up to this point if that was something that was necessary or worthwhile. So I do have that report from California from their Council of Judiciary Council, and I could provide that if the court would like to see it. However, I do not have any other statistics at this time.
Does it appear to you, then, that most states, when they've adopted their rule, they've kind of stuck with it? They haven't had to tinker with them because of problems?
According to our research, Chief, yes, that is the way that they work.
Okay.
The jurisdictions have not done much in the way of tinkering. Most of them have used a pattern or model from other states, like we're seeking to do here. However, they've usually tweaked them to fit the particular needs of their judiciary.
Okay.
Chief, you had talked earlier, and I'd like to get back to it, if I may, for just a moment. We had been discussing the argument that we should adopt this track because it will give more young and inexperienced attorneys the ability to go to trial. Again, we really shouldn't, we would argue that we should not adopt new procedures that for the benefit of attorneys, especially where significant procedures.
Well, it's really for the benefit of the public. If you've got an important case and you've got a rookie that doesn't know what he's doing for your attorney, it's going to affect you as well as the attorney.
Right. My other couple of responses to that are this. We have some other studies that have been done. In particular, I would cite the court to, and I can provide this as well, Short, Summary, and Expedited, The Evolution of Civil Jury Trials, which is a report that I believe came out within the last year or two, which goes through and analyzes the various expedited tracks throughout the United States. That report concluded, they looked at data from all the jurisdictions that have these expedited tracks. The studies have shown that these tracks, the trials in these tracks, are not well-suited to young and inexperienced attorneys. The reason I say that is trials are always limited in length from 3 to 6 hours, depending on what the particular rules are that are adopted. Presentation of evidence in the case must necessarily be heavily truncated, and only the most vital evidence and arguments can be presented at trials that are limited in that way. Most experts say that this type of analysis and prioritization taxes even the most experienced litigators. So many of those argue in these sources that you could read, that I could provide to the court, that inexperienced attorneys may not be the best suited and are probably not the best suited to handle these kinds of cases, which do require that kind of precision and analysis. This argument also has an inconsistency with some of the other arguments that are made in favor of the proposed rules without the opt-out. The proponents argue that the expedited track will help to save judicial resources by streamlining litigation and trials for smaller cases, reducing overall caseload and burdens on courts. But now the proponents are arguing that the expedited track will allow more young and inexperienced attorneys to go to trial because more cases will go to trial, given the mandatory track and the date certain and dates. So we would just question how it could simultaneously be true that it will reduce the amount of trials and save judicial resources, but at the same time increase the number of trials for those young and inexperienced attorneys to have that experience. So again, to summarize the arguments on the voluntariness, I think I've probably beaten that to death and taken a lot of this court's time this morning. We would ask that the proposed rules be changed to allow either a stipulation at the outset or an opt-out by either side later in the litigation. The second argument that we make in our brief is that the summary judgment procedures should remain unrestricted. The proposed rules for the expedited track remove failure to prove an essential element. We've already discussed that somewhat here today. Again, Iowa is the only jurisdiction out of the 22 in the United States with expedited tracks that has any kind of restriction on the ability to file summary judgment. Now, by that I only mean the grounds for summary judgment. Limitations on the number of summary judgment motions, for example, these proposed rules make the limitation one summary judgment, although multiple arguments can be raised for summary judgment in that motion. We're simply talking about the grounds upon which summary judgment can be made. We've not heard any arguments on why this summary judgment procedure should be restricted in this way here in South Dakota. We think that this court has said multiple times, has upheld the virtues and value of summary judgment. This court views summary judgment as, quote, an integral part of the civil system as a whole, designed to secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. As we see it, and we would argue to this court, if parties are required to wait, and this would be plaintiffs and defendants, because there will be counterclaims as well, if plaintiffs and defendants are required to wait until halfway through trial to make something like a motion for judgment as a matter of law, that's going to only increase the cost of litigation. Again, this could be used as a weapon by litigants on both sides, filing it in the expedited track, forcing it to trial, and having to incur all that expense, potentially hoping to leverage a settlement. So as we see it, any other result would undermine the entire purported purpose of the expedited track by allowing legally unsupportable claims to go to trial. When used properly, motions for summary judgment can help achieve greater efficiency, and they do that regularly. At the very least, we would argue that this court should allow unrestricted summary judgment motions if the expedited track will continue to be mandatory. There must be some ability to address claims that are legally groundless or that lack an essential element in the evidence. Just to respond to a couple of the arguments that we've heard from the proponents up to this point, the main argument, again, is that the costs of civil discovery are too high and that we need a cheaper alternative for smaller cases that have a maximum value of $75,000. As we see it, we already have a cheaper alternative, our small claims procedure. We would ask the question, why not simply raise the cap on cases that may be introduced in small claims court? Why not conduct a comprehensive review of our small claims procedures and consider reforms to those existing tracks? that we've heard no complaints. Perhaps the court has, but we've heard no complaints that the small claims track or the small claims procedures are not working, whether they're unsatisfactory for litigants in South Dakota. Again, the reasons in the 22 reasons, the main reasons the 22 jurisdictions adopted expedited tracks are, one, dissatisfaction with problems with mandatory ADR and the fact they had no appeal rights from there, and then, two, problems with interminable delay in getting cases to trial, such as in Iowa. As we see it, neither of these are problems in South Dakota. And then the final argument we'd make in response to that is we should wait to see what happens in states like Iowa, Minnesota, and Texas that have the mandatory track to see if the evidence does bear out that there is a cost-saving feature of and a cost-saving benefit in reality to these expedited tracks. We're also hearing the point that, and we believe it's true, that the expedited track is supported by the South Dakota trial lawyers and the South Dakota defense lawyers. I would just point out Woods Fuller is not opposed to the general concept of an expedited track with some of the changes we've discussed. The problem here is simply within a few of the proposed rules. As far as I know, the organizations that support the concept, like Woods Fuller does, can be supportive of the overall concept, but at the same time, we would hope that they would also support changes to the rules which will protect the rights of both sides and the protections of both sides. In conclusion, South Dakota has an efficient, strong judiciary and a bar association made up of competent litigators who strive to save costs wherever possible. We do not have the problems that Iowa sought to address with its expedited track here in South Dakota, with the possible exception of the cost of litigation. We think there are other ways of addressing those. Certainly the expedited track could be one of those, provided that the protections of the substantive and procedural rights are still in place. This overall concept would have a very viable place in our civil justice system, as long as those protections are in place. We would ask that this court follow the vast majority of jurisdictions, and when adopting an expedited track, please let it be voluntary in some way, and please preserve summary judgment rights for the parties. Any further?
Yes, not. Thank you for, appreciate you coming out today. You did file, but it's always good to work on these fine points, which you can only do orally rather than just submitting that, so I appreciate you coming.
Certainly, Justice. And Justice Kern, I will make sure that that report is filed with the court as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any other people wish to speak in opposition to this proposal? Or are not completely thrilled with it? I guess Mr. Smith said he was not totally opposed, so. All right. Then if there are no other opponents, proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Tom Barnett representing the State Bar. I have Bob Morris with me, and he will handle the court's questions on the actual technical aspects. The only reason why I decided to get up is because I think we've raised some public policy issues, and I thought the court may be interested in what's driving this. We set up a strategic planning committee about 5 years ago to study the overall system of justice. And then about 2 years ago, at our request, the Chief Justice appointed a task force on legal services. The common theme, if I want to look at it, to take a step back across the entire country, is access to justice. And we have the wealthy who can afford to hire the lawyers and litigate and use discovery and go forever and ever. We have legal services and a referral system, which is our access to justice, that handles those people who are poor. Our concern and what drove this was the Constitution of South Dakota guarantees all our citizens access to our courts. But as a practical matter, when you balance perhaps some statutory rules versus the Constitution, we think the Constitution trumps that. So how do we as a profession address the inability in many cases of our citizens to get access to a jury trial? And we believe that this is an access issue And we believe that that interest of the clients, of the constituents, of our citizens out there, trump, perhaps, to a degree, the accustomed way that we've handled summary judgment. I can talk anecdotally. South Dakota in the mid-70s, the legislature was addressing medical malpractice. And they enacted a number of statutes that made it more difficult, restricted the remedies of the plaintiffs. After a couple years, led by Joe Barnett, they decided to enact what I characterize as small claims for Med-Mal. No claim over $50,000. And it did exactly what was previously argued. It required both sides to agree to use the expedited, cheap method for Med-Mal resolution. It's never been used, ever. And I'm told that every time a plaintiff suggested that whether it's defense counsel or the defendant insurance carrier, they've never been willing to stipulate. So that's been on the books, and to my knowledge, it's never, ever been used. Anecdotally, I would also bring to the court's attention, everybody at this bench and Justice Wilbur listening in has a background of circuit court experience. In my shop over a block to the west, the most difficult letter I have to write is to a complainant that said, I've got this $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 claim, and I filed in small claims, and that lawyer removed me, and now it's a jury trial, and I have to forget it because I can't do a jury trial. And I have to send them a letter and say, that's not a violation of the rules because the rules allow removal to the formal side or the circuit side. So I said, there is no remedy. I'm not going to tell you the classes of individuals who routinely remove to the formal side or to the circuit level. I can tell you that it is a problem, and it's a bad reflection on our profession because we get the blame even if it's the defendant themselves that make that election. So is it anecdotal? Yes, but it's a problem, and I suspect that in your background as circuit judges, you probably saw that in your courtrooms. So we view this as an access to justice. Justice delayed is justice denied. And so we very much believe in the policy of fast track, and we believe that this was carefully balanced as best they can to achieve all those principles and give access to our citizens to a jury trial. The fact that it will afford an opportunity for perhaps younger lawyers to develop professional, that's secondary. That's a secondary benefit in our opinion, but the primary purpose of going with fast track was to give our citizens justice that they can afford and that it's also timely. And I ask for your favorable consideration. And like I said, Mr. Morris will answer your technical questions.
One general question. Who is at the table participating in the formulation of this proposal?
I think Mr. Morris can give you the names. I believe there was four circuit judges and four or five lawyers, litigants, both defense and plaintiff, from that President Freeberg appointed to develop this. And I don't know how many times they met. Mr. Morris served on that committee, so he's in a better position to answer your question, Justice Sinner.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Barnett from the bench? If not, thank you, Mr. Barnett. Well, your arrival, Mr., has been announced. Mr. Morris, we'll hear from you next.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. Bob Morris, Belfouche, South Dakota. First of all, personally and professionally, we appreciate that the objectors filed information indicating what their objections were, and having a representative here. I'm a firm believer that if everyone's agreeing, only one person's thinking. So I think this gives us an opportunity to have a conversation. To give you a little background, the committee was formed by the Bar Commission and the Supreme Court. From the Bar Commission, Clint Sargent was the chair, Magistrate Judge Carmen Means, was a member, Don McCarty was a member, and myself was a member. From the judiciary, it was Judge Long, Judge Brown, Judge Feifley, and Judge Day. Now, if you took the judicial experience, knowing that the judges at one time were lawyers, practicing lawyers, and you took the practicing lawyers on that list, there are hundreds of years of experience in litigation in South Dakota, in our courts. And so the task and the goal was to, first of all, essentially look at the Iowa model. And so we did that. And the large document was one of the documents that each one of the members of the committee had. And then we had the Iowa model. I gave to Ms. Fergal the Iowa model, and I believe you all have a copy of that that contains footnotes and annotations. And so we took a look at that, and there were no face-to-face meetings. There were conference calls. There was email exchange. And one of the issues that Iowa was looking at was that these were the things that they looked at in terms of the what's called the ECA rule, the Expedited Civil Action. Reduce litigation time and cost, increase access to justice, preserve the traditional jury trial, and preserve a party's right to appellate review. Now, that large packet of materials from the task force that was 3 years. They started prior to January 12th. They submitted their report in January 2012. The Supreme Court vetted it in October 2014. The Supreme Court of Iowa indicated their intention to implement some of the recommendations. And then the ECA was implemented on January 1, 2015. I read there's the Iowa Judicial Newsletter and the one from, I believe it's quarterly. The most recent one would indicate that 26 cases were filed within the first month of adoption. So, and the other thing that I think it's important to note that the task force, the information in the task force wasn't solely based upon a review of an expedited civil action. Iowa was going through the process. They were reviewing all of their discovery rule, all of their court rules regarding litigation. And part of those new rules, I believe they implemented, were in the rules of discovery, were the mandatory disclosures, what we call the Rule 26 parties meeting in federal court, and a number of other things. So the expedited civil action, the ECA, was merely one component of what that task force job was to do. So what we as a committee did is we took a look at the ECA and that was proposed by Iowa, and we looked at it. And part of the idea was is in going through it, it made sense. When you look at the expedited process, part of it is this, is that the discussion from the objectors is it should be voluntary. Well, everyone, and it's not anecdotally for me, I'm a practitioner of 27 years. I have clients that come to me who have exercised the right of the jurisdictional amount, I believe it's $14,000 in small claims. They filed it. That's supposed to be a speedy, affordable right to access to justice. They file a small claims case. The defendant has the wherewithal and ability to hire a lawyer. That lawyer then has two choices. Remove it to the formal side of magistrate court for a jury trial and the right to appeal to the circuit court, or remove it to circuit court and have all the necessary rules that go with a circuit court action. Now, most of the time, and all you're going to get is $14,000. So the question becomes, if there's going to be a counterclaim, I understand why you want it to go to circuit court, especially if it's a substantial counterclaim. But if it's $14,000, are you really removing to the formal side of the court or circuit court because you want to preserve your rights, or is it being done to stifle this individual's ability to seek access, affordable access to justice?
Do we have any statistics, Mr. Morris, as to how often that occurs? I didn't see it often in Pennington County. Less than five times in 18 years?
I don't have those area. But
certainly it happens, but sure. Is it a problem as far as frequency?
Well, it's a problem when the case is less than $14,000 in terms of the public's perception of their ability to exercise their right to seek redress.
Another question I have is, how was this vetted with the bar as a whole? When was this committee formed, and then how was it vetted? Has the bar had an opportunity to weigh in beyond the notification for the rules hearing and our proceedings today?
Yes, this is what we did. I believe the committee was formed in the middle of last year after the July Bar Commissioners meeting. Then the committee went to work, and we had our discussions, had our email exchanges. We had multiple drafts of the ECA. One of the things that we had to make sure of when we're looking at this draft and we're looking at the potential of proposing this is that we did not change any substantive law, and I'll address a few of those issues later. So we drafted it, and then the committee as a whole, I want to say by October, was unanimous in presenting the ECA that's in the proposed rule or variation of it to the Bar Commissioners. The Bar Commissioners then approved it and said, but before we submit it to the Supreme Court, we would like it to be vetted at a minimum by the trial law organizations. So it was submitted to the South Dakota Trial Lawyers Association by their board. They reviewed it. I believe they took formal action and approved it. It was also presented to the South Dakota Defense Lawyers Association for their review and any comments. They did not, to my understanding, they did not take a formal position on it. They're a little bit more, we want to find out what our members think about the process or the whole thing. So they didn't take a formal position. But what they did do is they assigned a committee to look at it. And that committee was of three, I believe, committee of three. And I believe the their request was that the discovery limitations for 10 interrogatories, 10 requests for production, and 10 requests for admission be amended to include subparts. So if you have, you can have one request for production, number one request for production, and if you put A, B, C, and D, those subparts would be included. So that was their request for recommendation. That was brought back to the committee. It was sent out to the committee. There was an email exchange. No one had an issue with that. And so as amended, the committee agreed, and the Bar Commissioners agreed, and then we presented to this court in its present form.
And so the rule as proposed, does it vary from the Iowa rule in substance, or is it identical?
In substance and content, not identical. And I'll go to a few of the areas to address. I'm working from my notice of special rules hearing. The first one is eligible actions. And the eligible action is a where the sole relief is a money judgment, so no equitable claims. That cannot be pursued in this particular forum. The other thing is that there's a limitation on the amount. Now, it's $75,000. Essentially, what the rule is that the jury, one, is not told that there's a limitation. Two, if the jury's verdict is more than $75,000, the judge ratchets it, in the old remitter, ratchets it down to $75,000. Now, in Iowa, Iowa said it's $75,000, but it excludes prejudgment interest, post-judgment interest, and costs. And so what they would do, their rule said you get prejudgment interest from the date you file the complaint. In South Dakota, we have statutory authority, which is substitute, that says you're entitled to prejudgment interest from the date of injury. So it was the committee's consensus that we could not address, do anything to change how prejudgment interest is calculated, because then we would be affecting a substantive statutory right. So the way it would work, let's say we go to jury trial and the jury gives the plaintiff $60,000. Then the prejudgment interest, say, is 15. Then the costs are 5. So now we're at 75. We're at $80,000, which is over the amount, but that's authorized because it's the verdict that can't be more than 75, but prejudgment interest and costs and any post-judgment interest, and even in cases where attorney's fees are allowed by statute or contractually, that would allow the amount to go over 75. But the jury verdict cannot be more than $75,000. So then we move down to the excluded actions. Does not apply to small claims or domestic relations. So essentially, by the default, perhaps, is that the small claims process doesn't adopt the expedited rule. The small claims process is still present. Now, if someone wants to pursue $10,000 and use the expedited rule, they can, in my view, but why would they? Unless they're concerned about the particular matter being removed to circuit court. So the small claims process still exists. And it's and this applies to cases where it is filed in circuit court, and the damages that are being sought are, you can want $100,000, but you have to know you're only going to get 75. And I'll address how the plaintiff and or the plaintiffs and the plaintiff's lawyer must address that.
Mr. Morris, before we get away from it, just. So that Justice Sinner and I don't get into a grammar dispute at some point. One thing, when I read this, I took it, says, each side may serve no more than 10 interrogatories, including subparts on each side. What I understood you to say was maybe a different inflection or different comma, that you could have 10 interrogatories and subparts to it. And there's a huge difference.
What
was the intent, and do we need to clarify by using different language here?
Well, I'll give you this caveat. I'm the last person in the world really to get involved in a deep discussion about grammar.
Well, what was the intent?
The intent is this, is that it includes subparts. And under the federal rules,
what are you saying that you can have 10 interrogatories with 10 subparts under each, or that you have 10 questions that including all, if you have one interrogatory with 9 subparts, that's 10?
From a practitioner's standpoint, this is how it would come about. Please state the following, : your name, your address, your date of birth, present employment, any other. That's the subparts. So if you want to waste all of your 10 interrogatories with that, then you're entitled to do that. Okay. From a realistic standpoint, and I'll jump into what we're talking about now is proportionality. And we had a strategic planning committee meeting on Friday. And one of the individuals who was invited there was Judge Schreier, from a federal district court judge, Judge Karen Schreier. And she gave us an update as to what the federal rules are looking at. And they're right now, I believe, they're in the proposed stage, and that they will be, they're being looked at. And one of the things is proportionality. And because this federal court system is hearing the same complaints regarding the expense of discovery in proportion to the amount of money or the remedies being reviewed. So the issue of discovery in an expedited case being 10 interrogatories, including subparts, is a proportionality issue. And I'll be realistic again. Whether I think this goes on a lot, but with computers nowadays, and if you're a plaintiff that all you do is plaintiff's work, or if you're a defense lawyer and all you do is defense work, if you're a good lawyer, you have a great stock set of of interrogatories and requests for production. You dictate to your secretary or paralegal, I need a stock personal injury, car accident interrogatories, and you might get 50 of them. And that's fine if it quit there. But what happens then, you go to a deposition, and the plaintiff or defendant is being deposed, and it's the same questions that are being asked, preparatory questions that are being asked in the deposition that are already addressed in the interrogatories. Okay? So the proportionality is to get back to that issue of affordable access to justice. And it's also to get to the issue, in my view, of speedy access to justice. And my belief is this expedited, this ECA, if adopted by this court eventually, will make lawyers that use it better lawyers. Because if you have an opportunity, and all, your opportunity is only to come up with 10 interrogatories, including subparts, you're going to want to focus on the stuff you need now, and that's very important to you, and same with the request for production of documents. And you can take that deposition then, and a lot of the things that you could have, that you normally would have asked in interrogatories, you can now ask in a deposition, rather than it being duplicative and an additional cost. So the intent is, if you can ask 10 interrogatories, or if you ask 5 interrogatories and each one has a subpart, that's 10.
Okay.
Electing the expedited procedure. Now, I understand the opponents saying, well, this is a plaintiff can only elect. It should be voluntary. We should be able to opt out. There was discussion on that. And anecdotally, from the stuff I've read about the Iowa rule, that came about too. And the response is this. The plaintiff is giving up something. The plaintiff is giving up the right of potentially getting a verdict more than $75,000. So by giving up that right and wanting to have a more affordable and a speedier access to resolution, then that is why it is a plaintiff elect. If you get into the situation where both parties have to agree, then it's not, the system won't be there. You're not solving anything. But I will add this. There's a provision on the bottom of page 2. It's called the stipulated expedited civil action. If a lawsuit is filed and the plaintiff does not exercise the expedited rule, both lawyers can get together and the clients can get together and say, you know what? I know you didn't file this under the expedited rule, but my client would probably like to use this expedited rule. You didn't use it. Can we use the expedited process? And this rule provides that as long as it's not excluded, which is small claims or domestic relations, and it's only for money judgment, the parties can stipulate to the expedited rule. And part of that stipulation is the $75,000 limitation doesn't apply. Because a lot of times, after 27 years, say in a car accident case, It's really not a liability issue that's there. It's a damages issue. It's how much, and so there's a lot of cases where you know it's not $75,000 and it's probably not $50,000, but you sit there and you toil through the process because we as lawyers are difficult to change. We have a routine, and so it's always the interrogatories. It's always the request for production. It's always the depositions. You know, you go on. This giving an opportunity to both parties to stipulate and use the process, I think will serve not only the profession, but the judiciary and the public's perception of the judiciary and the public's perception of our profession. So that's the reason it's plaintiff-oriented, is because the plaintiff is giving up something. And I had Ms. Fergal give you a copy. We've created one form in this committee because we felt it was important for the court and anybody that is looking at this. When you elect the expedited procedure, this is another variation of the Iowa form. And you as a lawyer have to sit down with your client, and it's kind of an informed consent process. Certifies that the sole relief is a money judgment. Certifies that I'm the plaintiff represented by an attorney. I have conferred with my attorney about using the ECA available, the understanding that the most I can get is $75,000, essentially a verdict excluding prejudgment interest. And so it then makes that attorney to give that option to the client. If the client says, I don't want to go that way, that's fine. But if the expedited process is invoked, there would be, according to the rules, there would have to be a filing like this document. Then we have the civil rules, the South Dakota Rules of Civil Procedure. We put in there that they otherwise apply, except unless they're modified here, and that's the 10. That way, there may be issues or discovery rules that are revised. They would apply in this situation. For instance, Iowa uses the very similar to the federal rules, the self-initiated disclosure and that process. And if that ever came before this court and those rules were changed automatically, because generally the rules apply unless modified by this, then those rules would be applicable also. Then there's a limitation on damages. I talked about the stipulated expedited civil action. The termination of expedited civil action, depending on a situation, I guess if a plaintiff elected and then the doctor said, things aren't going as good as I thought they should have gone. There's going to be a need for surgery. The surgery is going to cost $50,000. Then that lawyer is going to have to look at his client and probably get an affidavit from the doctor, make a motion that the expedited civil process can't work in this particular situation. So it remains fluid. And through this vetting process, the question came up, how do we know what's good cause? What is it? That's what judges and lawyers do. There's body of law developed by this court. What's good cause? What isn't good cause? If there's an issue, then good lawyers and good judges will resolve those issues.
Did the committee discuss the appealability of a termination order, whether it's a grant or a denial, either way?
That's not addressed here.
I know it's not. That's why I asked.
And
if you think about it,
I've had a jury trial in front of you, and you've asked questions that I didn't have answers to. I don't have an answer to that. It would be you know, would be considered interlocutory order.
Well, it's not a final. It probably isn't a final order.
No.
The question is, should it be appealable or not?
Well, can I speak outside the box a little bit without the benefit of vetting this with my committee?
Yeah. It's the committee you got to answer to.
If a party makes a motion to the judge, okay, and the judge makes the decision, yes, we'll terminate or we'll opt out. I would like to think that the judge and the lawyers took every opportunity to think about the process and to say, this ECA process is here for a reason. Now there come a time where the ECA process doesn't benefit the parties, or there's been a change in circumstance, and so the judge grants the order to terminate. I think you live with that at that time, because now you're into the regular, we'll call it the formal side of the circuit court. And why would you want to spend the money to appeal to the Supreme Court that I had to terminate, my case was terminated, but what, going to spend money, so on and so forth?
That makes sense, but what about a denial? Should you be able to appeal the denial of a request for termination?
Again, just thinking on my feet, I would say no. Because if you make the termination, a denial of the termination appealable, then you should probably make the granting of a termination appealable. So if you did, but the concept being is we want affordable, speedy access to justice, and if we start creating collateral procedures, then we are defeating the ultimate purpose.
I just ask because, obviously, if we adopt this, we're going to get... somebody's going to appeal it up here, mm-hmm. or try an appeal, and we're going to have to decide.
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and that question never came up in the process. But, you know, there's... You go... When you're involved in litigation, there's all sorts of orders and things that they get denied, and you wish you could appeal, or granted, and you wish you could appeal interlocutory, but that all those things sort of is what takes you through the process, and ultimately most of them don't affect your ability to try your case or to represent your client or affect your client's substantive rights. But that's a fantastic question. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer. Discovery. We talked about that. The proportionality, again, the 50 interrogatories with 100 subparts and 50 requests for production, the proportionality, if our goal is to make it affordable access to justice, the proportionality has to be present. And again, I go back, I think it'd make us better lawyers. Then there's the motion to dismiss. This is what's interesting. A motion to dismiss is still available. It says any party may file any motion permitted by essentially a 12B6. Unless the court orders a stay, the filing of a motion to dismiss will not eliminate or postpone otherwise applicable pleading or disclosure requirements. So if you do a 12B6, under this rule, you should still file an answer, and you should start your discovery, because once you file your complaint, there are time limitations. This case has to be tried within a year. Any summary judgment motions have to be filed within 90 days prior to trial. Discovery has to be completed 60 days before trial. And so the whole point being, even though you filed a motion to dismiss, then you must begin your track in order to stay on track. And generally speaking, we're a notice pleading state. Very seldom is a motion to dismiss ever granted. It may create a need for an amended complaint, but very seldom are motions to dismiss granted. The motion for summary judgment, and I appreciate the objector's questions on this. And we did get some questions about, you know, some of these are self-explanatory, but what does it mean but to raise any other matter constituting an avoidance or affirmative defense? Well, affirmative defenses are dictated in our statutes as statute of limitations, as an affirmative defense, waiver, estoppel, latches, those sorts of things, avoidance. Question came up about element of the claim. If you, in my view, don't have all the elements to meet a prima facie case, that's an avoidance. The summary judgment motion can be made, and there's an element lacking that's not supported factually.
You know, Mr. Morris, I think I'm just going from memory here, but I think that language comes from the affirmative defense rule in the rules of civil procedure. Mm-hmm. And I don't think failure to satisfy an element of a claim is the same as an affirmative defense.
But that's a failure to state a claim. And so
shouldn't we state that if that's what we mean? I mean, we that isn't what I saw it as meaning, and we're discussing it. Can't we just state that? I mean, that's pretty important.
To raise any other matter of avoidance and avoidance.
Avoidance? I don't know what avoidance means. Shouldn't we just state what we mean? I mean, are you intending to eliminate failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted?
Yeah, and I think maybe we got compartmentalized when we were reviewing this, because usually the failure to state a claim comes on the front end with your notice pleading. And then as you're going through discovery, you're learning the facts, and then you learn that the facts don't support the allegation in the complaint. Therefore, you don't call it a failure to state a claim anymore, technically. You call it, you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, summary judgment. So I think that would be to clarify that, the failure to state a claim in the summary judgment.
Or whatever it's called. You're not intending to eliminate that step, so you
end up going
through jury trial before you get to the point of saying there's no duty.
The biggest issue with summary judgment is material fact. You know, there's a difference between your summary judgment as a matter of law and your summary judgment technically as there exists no material fact. And just anecdotally or based upon my experience, there have been a number of cases that have come up to this court and have been reversed because material facts do exist. And a great number of cases are denied on motion for summary judgment because material facts do exist at the trial court level. And one of the fears is that we can't make our summary judgment motions, and part of that is, the way I've explained it is, think about it. When a plaintiff or defendant does a motion for summary judgment, you have a statement of material facts, you have a motion, you have a statement of material facts, you have a memorandum of law or brief in support of summary judgment motion. That's filed. The other side then responds to the statement of material facts, does the brief, and responds. Then there is the reply or response, however you want to call it. And so you have all this time and money and effort into a summary judgment motion that, if it's based upon material fact and it's not a legal issue, you know, you could have $10,000 to $15,000 worth of time. Then you have to be a realist too and understand that the circuit court, after the hearing, is still going to be able, is going to have to take a minimum, in most cases, 90 days or more to issue a decision, because our circuit court judges are very busy. So and then my response is, why waste all that time, energy, and money? Because if you want to brief it, go ahead and brief it, but at the end of the plaintiff's case, if you're defending, at the end of the plaintiff's case, submit a trial brief at the beginning. You put on the case and you say, Your Honor, we would move as a judgment as a matter of law based upon the evidence that's presented. And the judge can rule at that time or take it under advisement or defer. Again, getting back to the concept is we want affordable access to justice. And Judge Trandall was at our strategic plan meeting the other day, and she said something that struck me. Apparently, she's done a lot of reading on this. And she said, you know, litigants, the public's perception of lawyers and the justice system is different than what we understand it to be. We as lawyers and judges believe that litigants and people who use the courts are more interested in outcome because that's what we believe they're interested in. She said the studies show the litigants and the people that want to take advantage of the availability of courts are more interested in the process. So if we, the ECA, gives the affordable, speedy access to the process. And my concern is that if we put up too many barriers to prevent the process in these small cases, less than $75,000, to prevent that access or the affordability aspect to it. But the summary judgment on the failure to state a claim, that's a legal issue. And the other thing too is a summary judgment out there is established and used in larger cases especially in order to refine the issues and put the parties in a position to where they can get rulings from the court on certain legal issues, so it puts the parties in a position that they can explore settlement. Because you go into a case, especially in a large case, you have a number of issues, you have a number of theories. And in the large cases, the summary judgment is an excellent tool to vet what good claims there are and what bad claims there are. And in a small case, less than $75,000, and it's funny how you now always say small cases. When I started practicing law 27 years ago, if we settled a case for $75,000, our law firm would shut down and we would go out and have a get-together because that was a big case. But that was 27 years ago. So now when we talk about $75,000, we're talking about the smaller cases and the need for the ECA.
Before you get away from summary judgment, can you explain? You've got five sections. The last two is failure to provide notice of remedies. That makes sense, and we already talked about the avoidance or affirmative. But the first three are to collect an open account or liquidated debt, to establish an obligation to indemnity, and to assert indemnity. I don't understand what they mean. What do they mean in the context of summary judgment?
Usually there's no material issue of fact. It can be contractual, or it can be, there's not necessarily the need for a jury trial. An open account or other liquidated debt. Right now, say the AAA collections, they can only do $14,000. If they had a debt that was $35,000, $40,000, $50,000, or $60,000, the AAA collection plaintiffs could use the expedited rule. To do that, and then if it was contested, if it was contested by the debtor who now is the defendant, then these rules would apply. Same, establish an obligation to indemnify. Normally, that's contractual, but sometimes there may be some issues concerning factual issues that would arise, but seldom. But again, it's a $75,000 threshold or the maximum that would derive this. Immunity defense is judicial immunity or any other type of immunity that's applicable in state law. So again, The first three are essentially seldom are there material issues of fact. They're usually legal issues. I think that's a recognition of that.
Okay, so if we restate that to make it more clear what we're talking about, would that be?
Speaking for myself, yes, I believe the committee would agree with that, but I can't speak on behalf of the committee. But I do get your point.
It looks like this
might stay to Kite.
I think these came from Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let me ask you this. Is it your understanding that the summary judgment rule, these limitations, would prohibit a motion for summary judgment on the basis of lack of duty?
No, I do not, because duty is a legal question.
But where would that, which one of these five subdivisions?
Oh.
That's one of Woods Fuller's objections, and I'm trying to see where duty.
And I think that would be remedied by the failure to state a claim. Because if you have negligence is duty, breach of duty, proximate cause, and damages. If you don't meet all those elements, then you fail to state a claim. Technically speaking, or you're entitled to judgment as a matter of law on a summary judgment act.
But motion to failure to state a claim is a different rule. That's not summary judgment.
It's 12B.
Yeah. That's rule 12. This is rule 56.
But under the 12B process, you assume all of the factual assertions within the complaint are true. Okay?
Right.
So that's the standard of review. Then if the 12B6 motion is denied based upon I have to assume the facts are as stated. Now you go through discovery and you learn that the facts aren't as stated, but these are the material facts. Then if there's no dispute over the material facts and it shows that there's no duty, but duty is a legal, again, is a legal question. So in most cases.
So the answer is, at least as I read this, you could not make a motion for summary judgment based on lack of duty. You'd have to do it as a 12B motion.
With that particular pointed question in looking at this, probably not. And so if we change it to, and maybe I'm getting hung up on whether you can meet the prima facie, after discovery, whether you can meet the prima facie elements of your claim or not.
Could we use words similar to that and get to what you're talking about?
Right.
Still?
Let me, we can do this. Because these particular pointed questions weren't necessarily brought up in our process. I can get back to the court and submit perhaps these particular questions to the committee and address it and bring it back to you, or come up with another process to address those issues.
Well, let's may get actually with Mr. Smith also. There may be agreement on this if we just get the right language.
We can,
or at least try.
Sure. I can meet with them afterwards. We can try.
I have a quick question on trial setting on page 5. I note that there's going to be a firm date set for trial, except the court can reschedule the trial for another date during the same week. Can you provide some background on that?
That, excuse me. That came from the Iowa. As my understanding, it's the year deadline under the process, and then you come back, and then in the same week it might be impossible, but it's discretionary exactly when, and I don't think anything in here takes away from the court's discretion. Same week, maybe that maybe that's too constricted.
Well, perhaps you got an expert that got sick, or there was a huge blizzard, or just wondering if that was based on a stack week requirement, or
no, that came from the Iowa, and if an expert got sick, that would definitely be a good cause issue. Iowa, I'll kind of wrap this up. Expedited civil jury trial. Iowa uses six jurors. I believe the South Dakota Constitution and statutory in South Dakota require 12, petty jury. We put in here that the parties may stipulate to a jury of less than 12 upon such conditions. I've used a six-person jury in three cases and three jury trials, and again, both parties knew that it wasn't going to be a huge case. It creates a very intimate environment. And what I found interesting is when the judge said, "Do you all want to sit three stacked on three?" They said no. They wanted all six seats along the bar. And so it creates an intimate environment. Case never lasted more than a day and a half. So the parties can do less than six. I'll wrap up here. A lot of the rest of the material is self-explanatory. One of the big things that some people I would say are kind of excited about, perhaps. And it's interesting because it has nothing to do with the jury trial. And it's on page 5, the expedited non-jury trial. We've coined that as the jury of one process, where the judge is the finder of fact. The case is presented to the judge with jury instructions and a verdict form. And the judge hears the evidence, listens to the evidence, reviews the jury instructions, and then fills out a jury verdict form as a jury of one, and that's the decision. Now, the trial court in that case, in that situation, it's discretionary as to whether they must do findings of fact and conclusions of law. But I would think, from my standpoint, I would encourage the judge bench this, fill out the verdict form, and then if there's appellate review, then there's already the transcript of the trial and the jury instructions and the verdict form. But we would just have to wait and see how that all developed. Last thing, the healthcare provider statement in lieu of testimony, 1916.8.2. The Iowa system, they set up sort of a form that was more of a questionnaire that the doctor filled out. Under our existing rule, there's an affidavit that the doctor prepares that set forth the medical expenses, their opinions. And then under our rule, the opposite party has the opportunity to take that doctor's deposition and cross-examine.
Okay. One last question, I guess. Did the committee discuss a pilot program, the pros and cons of a pilot program? And a follow-up to that would be, in light of the discussion we've had this morning, do you think we should proceed, or do you think we should work this, smooth this out a little more, or do you think we should proceed with it?
To answer your first question, pilot program, I don't believe that whatever came up in the discussion. As to proceeding, I think that giving the committee an opportunity to address a couple of the issues here, and we can do that rather quickly, and I can talk to Mr. Smith and address the summary judgment. I think we could address those rather quickly and for the court to adopt, because there was hard work done on this. Sure, it wasn't the level of inquiry or review or polling in the Iowa thing, but in my view, sometimes it's better not to try to reinvent the wheel. And so the judges on the committee and the lawyers on the committee think we have a very good framework and a very good vehicle with the tweaks that we discussed here today, and I appreciate those questions. So I think maybe, you know, I don't know how the process works if you wait 30 days or 60 days or what you do, but if you could give us 30 days to get the questions addressed, we would do that quickly.
There, answer to your question, there is no set process. Sometimes we'll enact them the day we hear the hearing, but reasonable requests for extension are probably favorably viewed.
Okay.
Anything else?
No, unless there's any further questions, I believe I'm all right. Done.
Well, thank you for coming also to make a presentation today. We appreciate it.
You bet.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other persons wish to speak?
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Margo Northrup. I'm an attorney at the Ryder Rogers Law Firm in Pierre, South Dakota. I was not planning to give any presentation today. I just wanted to address one brief issue. I am the president-elect of the South Dakota Defense Lawyers, and really the position that we took is we thought it was a good enough idea that it needed to be vetted through this process and to have the membership have a chance to look at it and provide input. But the one issue I wanted to mention is in reference to the interrogatories and the subparts. My understanding is that what the defense lawyer committee requested is that that be 10 interrogatories in addition to subparts. So you could have a 1, A, B, and C all the way through 10. So it wouldn't be just, you know, A through G. You would be able to have an interrogatory with subparts. So that was the only thing I wanted to clarify.
Wait a minute.
So it would be...
You're saying, I think, the opposite of Mr. Morris. So if you have one interrogatory with 9 subparts, you're saying that's one interrogatory. But doesn't the exception eat the rule then? You could have 100 subparts to one interrogatory. Doesn't that defeat the whole purpose?
Well, that could potentially be an abusive process. Like what I wanted just to portray is what I think that the committee had requested is that it would be one interrogatory per subpart. What I thought I would do, if it's allowable, is maybe just submit something in writing clarifying that specific point from the defense lawyers.
Well, get something that isn't going to get abused.
Absolutely.
That's what we're trying to get.
Yep, absolutely.
How do you do that? I mean, do the subparts have to be material to the general question? I mean, this is an unanswerable question, it seems to me.
Well, you could just arbitrarily say no more than 3 or 5 subparts.
Yeah, I agree, and that's exactly why I really didn't want to get up and address that issue, because it's much more complicated than just whether it's how many subparts or how you define that. But my understanding was the defense lawyer thought it would be 1 plus A through E,
okay.
10 times.
I don't really think you need to write it. We get it.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, unless you have a solution. I mean, I'd welcome a solution.
Okay, thanks.
Any other persons wish to speak? If not, I'd like to thank you all for coming this morning. It's been an excellent discussion, although it's nominally considered a formal hearing. This give and take is extremely helpful to the court in identifying where we need to study further. So if there being nothing further, we are in recess.